Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Public Radio. And this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, Fresno's mayor wants to hear from you. Should the city have a private company pick up your trash? And the farm labor shortage, how real is it, and how is it impacting local agriculture? Plus, kids invent. But first, in the wake of an ongoing budget crisis, Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen is considering outsourcing the city's residential trash service, and she's asking for the public to weigh in. The mayor has put a question and answer page on the city's website and is asking residents to participate in a survey. Now, you may recall, over the last year or two, there has been a huge battle to have a private company take over the city's commercial trash pickup. That move is expected to generate about $3 million a year in fees. Here to discuss this issue with us is Fresno City Councilman Lee Brand. Councilman Brand, thanks so much for coming in this morning.
Good morning, Juanita. Thank you.
Well, you know, if I recall, you did support the city outsourcing the commercial trash. Now, do you support this latest consideration, which is outsourcing residential trash?
Conceptually, I support, excuse me, allergies.
It's that time of the year, isn't it?
Yeah, for me. And I conceptually, subject to a detailed review, I think that the difference this time, Juanita, from – well, it wasn't easy last time. It's always difficult to go through any kind of privatization that affects people's lives, their employment. But on the residential, I think it'd be a little more difficult because there's really the motivation is not because the people do a bad job; they do a good job. It's not because the costs are high, because I think, well, I know from my business, we do business in many cities, that Fresno is one of the cheapest in terms of its garbage rates, its water rates, et cetera. So it's not because the rates are too high; it's simply borne by necessity. The city is in a desperate financial situation. The normal revenues of property tax, sales tax, room tax, they're flatlined. They're just not going up. And we have rising costs in health care and some of the employee benefits and other, you know, debt costs. So we need to find permanent, you know, not just a one-year, two-year funding streams. And that's, you know, you mentioned earlier, the commercial was roughly $3 million a year. This is projected at $2.5 million a year. So that's the motivation.
And right now, as far as we know, I mean, these are all projections because commercial hasn't been in operation long enough, has it, for us to really see yet?
Well, actually, this year, which would be the second, going into the second year, the franchise was actually $700,000 higher than projected. Because when you go initially, it's just based on a series of assumptions. So the assumption was roughly $3 million, but and it may vary from year to year, but it was actually higher. So the assumption now is $2.5 million for a full year. For this fiscal year, it's based on, it received at least four votes through the end of December, because there's a process of, one, you have to approve the hiring a consultant. The consultant develops an RFP for bidders. And then the second vote is going to go through what bidders are bidders. Is it one, two, three, four? What model do we pick? And then there's a series of three votes per our charter on the franchising to eventually, and that is scheduled to be done by December, with the actual implementation, assuming it's successful, on March 1st. So that prorated amount is roughly $1 million this fiscal year.
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, the proposal is a long way from reality, but it's my understanding that the city did go ahead and pass a budget based on funds that would be generated if the city does move forward with outsourcing commercial trash pickup. Now, was that a wise thing to do? And we haven't even gone through the process yet, but we've already put that in our budget, the city's budget, and they're depending on that.
Every budget, this is the fourth one that I've been involved with, has assumptions. It assumed just about every year that it assumed certain employee groups would make concessions. It assumed property tax and sales tax would be at given levels. The entire budget, the roughly $230 million general fund, is full of assumptions. A couple years ago, it was an assumption that we were going to privatize solid waste. Do I agree with some of these? Not necessarily. There was an assumption in this year's budget that we'd get roughly $4 million from the Fresno police officers in a concession that at least at this point in time does not look like it's going to materialize. So there are
So you're having to look at other options.
Yes.
Is that somewhat argue that that is the reason why the city is falling back on and looking at commercial trash, and that the real cost when it comes to a city's budget is, you know, employees and the cost of employees, and not getting the concessions from law enforcement, then you have to look somewhere else.
Well, here's the real problem. You know, we in 2008, the economy went off the cliff. Everybody's still suffering. It's the Great Recession of 2008. And from that period of time, you know, all the revenue sources at the state level in most cities, now some states are doing better, but California, they've dropped dramatically. They're not recovering. So that alone would be a major obstacle for any city to overcome. But our situation is different in that what went on the previous 8-9 years had a huge impact on us today. For example, there were many decisions regarding like parking garages, stadiums, convention center, several bond measures that were passed, public safety bonds, no neighbors left behind bond, et cetera, that nearly doubled the city's debt service from 2004 to 2009. And those are like 30-year, 20-year decisions. In addition to those new bonding measures that came in, and I'm not saying they were good, they all had good benefits, but I don't think they thought out how do you pay them back. And that's when we've got that. We also had several bonds like the pension obligation bond that was originally floated in 1992, was scheduled to be paid off in 2012, 2013. It was refinanced. It's like getting your home and saying, oh, it's a better interest rate. It was refinanced in 2001, refunded, and extended out to 2029. It would have been paid off by now. That's $16.2 million every single year, of which $12 million are responsible for the general fund. Those are the decisions. There were labor decisions made even in the waning days of the prior administration. We had a press conference last Monday, regarding, you know, this is the police and what was given and taken. But since 2006, you know, 2% raise, 3% raise, step increase, et cetera, the city manager had measured between 2006 and 2015, when their MOU expires, $67 million worth of concessions. In that same period of time, we received $14 million in give back, so there's a net of $53 million. But of that $67 million, this is the important point, 90% or $60 million of it was MOUs negotiated prior to January 1st, 2009. We inherited the equivalent of $60 million of MOU obligations. So you mentioned the biggest part of our challenge is these MOUs, not just from them, other groups too, that we have to honor. If that includes higher pension, if that includes a different health care or a step increase, we're legally obligated to honor those deals. So you take an economy that was going in the wrong direction and you combine all this, you know, this baggage that we inherited, it's amazing that we're still not, you know, we're not going to file bankruptcy. We're going to find a way to go through it. That is our challenge.
Well, thanks for explaining it. You're a very good finance guy, and you're always a good person to have in and come in and talk about a budget situation. But the hardworking people, because not everybody who works for the city is, you know, an employee making, you know, big bucks. They're everyday folks. Then some would argue, is it fair that those people have to pay for, you know, some of the decisions that were made mm-hmm. by former city leaders? I mean, we see it time and time again that decisions are made not very good decisions. And down the road, the only way you have to deal with them is that somebody's got to go or somebody's got to pay.
Yeah, I agree. And the short answer is yes, but the explanation is there's a lot more to it. You know, just take the Granite Park, the Met Museum. We all know there were classic failures. There's a $20 million loss combined. But that's a one-time $20 million loss. When you have MOUs that you negotiated prior that have ongoing $5, $6, $7, $8 million, that's every single year. Within so many years, they eventually become a lot of money too. And you know, the reality is, and people don't, you know, have to look at this, is that, you know, public safety, police and fire are treated differently. And I would be the first one to argue that they should be treated differently, because what they do, the job they do, the inherent risk they take, should be compensated differently than what a, you know, account clerk does or somebody who sits behind a desk. And the reality is, in every single city, the POAs are, you know, the fire are typically the power brokers because of their unique nature and so on, and we have to deal with that. And so are there inequities? Yeah, you're right. There's inequities. And sometimes as this thing rolls down, ultimately it'll fall on some people like, you know, the garbage workers. But I'm still looking for other solutions.
Well, you know, some would argue then if, you know, if we've passed a budget already and depending on money from privatizing commercial, I mean, residential trash, that really then that is kind of a moot point. The mayor and others have already made up their mind that this is what they need to do. Now they're just trying to convince everybody else.
Well, again, this is a $232 million budget, and that's only $1 million of it right now. And so in context, even the $4 million from that was assumed to be from the FPOA negotiation, that's 1% or 2%. If I'm doing, you know, it's a private company. We're projecting we make Apple phones, and we're going to project $230 million. You know, a sales blip one way or the other, a change in a production line can make that go 2, 3, 4, 5%. So there'll be many mitigating factors between now and June 30th, including where does sales tax actually come in? Where does property tax come in? You know, the gasoline prices, for example, are dropping. So that's a significant part of our budget. That could save $1 million.
Yeah.
So to say that that's in there is a foregone conclusion isn't necessarily true.
Okay. Well, you know, privatizing is something a lot of cities are dealing with. I'd like to have our listeners weigh in. Considering what Councilman Brand said, when it comes to commercial and residential trash, and the fact that these were both self-sustaining entities within the city government, and that you know, the fees were covering their costs, so it really wasn't costing anything. Well, considering that, how do you feel about the city deciding to privatize some of its services? We'd like to hear what you have to say about that, and you can give us a call at 800-224-8989 or 559-275-8989, or you can email us at talk@kbpr.org. Again, that's 800-224-8989. 89 or 275-8989. Like to hear from you on this issue. Some people might also say, as we move down this path, that it might be kind of wise, and I know you've already talked about it a little bit, really to see how our commercial trash deal is working out before we move to privatize residential trash, because then you would have something to look at. Even though they're both different, and could probably, if the other one is going well, could kind of boost your argument.
Well, I have looked at it because my business, which is property management, we manage thousands of apartment units, so we were directly impacted on this transition between the city and the private providers, and there were some issues involved in that. One of the big issues on the apartment side was the rates. But the problem was that the city, UAC, the Utility Advisory Commission, had made recommendations, including a one-time 10% adjustment, because the methodology that was used was actually subsidizing apartments. That was never done. So consequently, apartments went up about 10%, but they would have anyway.
Okay. We do have a caller. Edward, Kern County?
Yes.
And what do you have to say this morning?
A few things. One has to do with...
maybe I shouldn't have asked that question. Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm concerned with privatization of the commons. These are good jobs that support families. With privatization, obviously, the workers are going to be paid with less benefits and less monies. But there will be a profit going to the owners of these trash companies. Again, it reflects back on this is being done on the backs of the workers who did not do this. It's the incompetence of the leaders of our communities that are causing this, and they walk away with their big fat pensions or golden parachutes, etc. Another point is you are breaking unions by separating the police and fire from the other workers. Makes it easier for them to break up strikes or labor disputes because they are not part of it. And that, I think, is criminal. It's a design, I think, to divide and conquer. I think that the leaders have caused this should be held accountable. Maybe their pay should be reduced to match the reduction of the problem. There again, the unions can work with in the framework of this budget problem. It's not like you have to get rid of it. But they want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, get rid of years and years, decades of work rules for the common man. So and blame it on them because they don't want to do the difficult task of raising taxes until this crisis is over or whatever they have to do. But the unions will work within this framework, but they want to, again, get rid of them all. And that's about it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Edward, for your comments this morning. Joe?
Yes.
And your comments this morning?
I was wanting to comment about the garbage department.
Go ahead. You're on.
Yeah, well, I was listening to Lee Brand, how he was talking about, but back in the past, all these bad decisions, You got all these bad decisions, and you think they would learn from it, but they don't. They keep making the same bad decisions, and they make the customers take the obligation from them, because they end up having to get rates, reduced or higher. And the truth is, the garbage department is self-sufficient. It pays for itself. Commercial, that was really a bad decision. And being a business owner that he says with apartment complex should know that the rates went up tremendously. And if you go around town and you look at the commercial side, you'll see all the graffiti on the bin. You'll see bins left out. You'll see gates unlocked. The services aren't provided like they used to be. So where is that really benefiting the customers? And now they want to go after residential. So what's going to happen then? The elderly ain't going to have, they're not going to have, their services done because I know they have special handlings. Are they going to get extra charge for that? They're on fixed incomes. So what are they going to do about that kind of stuff?
Okay. Thank you, Joe.
All right.
Appreciate your comments. Well, as you very well know, because you went through this whole thing with commercial, that, people feel very strongly about this. And a lot of them are folks who were impacted. And there is concern that once you privatize certain services, and we're talking about trash, that people aren't going to get the same service.
Mm-hmm. Well, using the transition on the commercial, and commercial, by the way, is much more complex than residential because you've got different types of properties. You've got apartments. You've got condos. You've got office buildings, retail. Everything's unique. It's much more cut and dry on residential. But I mentioned the one thing. They didn't pass their rates. That's part of the problem. The overall difference was roughly, when you figured all the properties in, was roughly a 2 or 3% increase in the prices. But part of the problem was the city itself. For example, the city had a property that they went out 3 times a week to service, but they only billed for 2 times. So the private provider comes out, he's gone twice, and the guy says, hey, my garbage is overflowing. Well, that's what the contract says. So how can you do the same thing? Or maybe they had the guy down for 2 5-yard bins, but he was only charged for 1 5-yard bin. So there was problems that the city had in its record keeping. There were problems in how things were done. From the server's point of view, I can relate to the properties we have, and I'm a member of the apartment association. I don't think anybody ever said the reason we did it was because the service wasn't good. I think the workers – in fact, I've talked to people at Allied, and they say the workers they hired – because they hired most of the workers from the city were really good workers. And the problem was some of the guys that got bumped from commercial were actually residential guys that went to Allied and had to learn how to drive a commercial truck. But it's not about the workers – or they're good people. They work hard. It's not about the service level. It's again, it's out of economic necessity. And most cities have privatized their residential and commercial rates. Fresno is kind of the exception.
Well, do they do that because that's a place where they can go and cut?
Yeah. For a good example of San Jose, about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, they privatized. They went to what they call a non-exclusive where they can have 20 or 30 carriers. Well, guess what? They got one carrier on an exclusive contract. I'm sure a lot of that was because of the money part of it and the, you know, the economies of scale.
Yeah. We have Michael.
Hi.
Hi, Michael. Your comments?
How are you?
I'm fine.
Good. I'm a Fresno resident. I do, you know, I like our residential trash the way it is. I want it public. The real issue here isn't about public versus private. The real issue here is that Mayor Ashley Schweringer and the gentleman want to privatize and get rid of, it's not about the money issue, they want to get rid of public employees. And, you know, I went online to answer the survey, which was in the newspaper, talked about.
Yes.
Nowhere did they ask the basic question, do you want your service privatized or do you want a public? They totally leave that question out, which tells them very clearly, I know Ashley, I supported her, that she wants to privatize this, not for the $1 million, but to get rid of public workers. The basic question for me is, do I have good service? The answer is yes. Number two, does that service pay for itself? The answer is yes. If the city needs to, they can always increase to cover the workers' costs. So it's not about the cost of the workers, because that is now covered and can be covered. It's about this mayor and her city manager want privatization and want to get rid of unions. And as a, you know, a long-time resident, I've been in the city for over 40 years. I deeply resent that. I deeply resent the fact that they are pushing their privatization program upon the city. They don't care about the quality of service, which we now get. We get an incredible quality of service from residential trash collection, and I want to see that maintained.
Well, thank you, Michael, for calling in this morning.
Thank you. Bye now.
And, you know, what he has to say is something that we're hearing all across, you know, the country, that mm-hmm. there are a lot of public employees who feel like they are being forced to take the responsibility of a lot of bad decisions, and they are paying the price. All of a sudden, it is the public employees they are blaming the public employees for the problems many cities are facing when it comes with their budgets. And a lot of public employees are feeling that way.
Can I respond?
Yes.
Yeah, you know, first of all, yeah, to a certain extent, you're right. There's no question about it. But in our case, the administration and the council members that are on now, we can't undo what was done for 10 years. And it was, I gave you an outline of all – it was a culmination of many, many things that – created excessive debt, MOU obligations we have to honor, and other expenses that, you know, our health care has went up. Our pension in 2006 was zero. It's $22 million now. In the next few years, they're going to adjust our presumed rate of 8% probably down to 7.5%. And when that happens, it's going to go up another, you know, $30, $40 million. I don't know. There's nothing we can do about that right now. Except,
but doesn't Fresno doesn't have the pension liability problem that a lot of other cities have?
That is the reason we're not in bankruptcy right now, in my opinion, is because we had a well-funded, well-managed pension problem. But everything is evolving, and the markets are changing. And again, this presumption that you can go on the stock market for 7.5-8% for years is no longer true. So everybody is changing their assumptions, and it's going to affect us too. But right now, I think I can say this clearly. I don't think anybody on the council or the mayor if they had other alternatives, would say, let's not privatize residential solid waste. It's born out of necessity. And my question to anybody and my council members, and I'll look at it myself, where are we going to find $2.5 million? Tell me which program you want to cut. Tell me if I go to Residents of Fresno and I say, which park do you want me to close? Which pothole is not going to be fixed? How many streetlights stay out? You're going to wait an extra hour for a fire truck to arrive. You're going to have your house broken into. It's going to take an extra hour to have a police officer or even do a phone response. Those are things we're looking at. And ultimately for us, what are the core services? What comes first in an era of limited resources and limited ability to meet those core services?
As one of the callers suggested, because trash is self-sustaining, mm-hmm. What about the possibility of raising fees?
Well, it won't make any difference because it's an enterprise department. If I raise the fees, if every worker agreed to take a 10% cut, we got our fuel cost down by prop, 218, and we dropped our costs, we'd have to drop our rates. The money part of it comes in the franchising. When you privatize to a private provider, they govern the rates. Then the city is allowed, and by state law and its charter, to get a franchise fee. And the question would be, well, how can you get $3 million and not raise their rates? Well, in the commercial side, that was a logical question. We went from two drivers per truck that the city had to the private model was one driver per truck. Well, you can start doing the math there if you have 100 drivers. And we had a task system that you could work basically 4 or 5 hours and get paid for eight, or you could do another 4 hours and get paid overtime. That adds a lot of cost. Because of these inefficiencies, it creates the opportunity for a private provider to meet its payroll, make a small profit, and pay the city a franchise fee. Now, I don't know how this is all going to shake down on the residential side because I haven't seen it. Because one, there's only one driver per truck. There's no problem there. They have a task system, probably not as the problem it was before. But ultimately, if to keep the rates, I can guarantee you for myself and probably most other people, I would never approve any model where the rates go up. In fact, they'd probably have to drop 1 or 2 or 3%. So is there a model out there they can maintain that level of service, keep the rates the same or slightly lower, and develop a franchise? If a franchise fee is $200,000 a year, it's not worth it.
Okay, let's see. We have another caller. Mike, hello.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Juanita and Lee.
Good morning.
Yeah, I don't envy your position. It seems like the current council is always getting beat up for things previous administrations have done, and then you don't get the credit, and nobody gets the credit when previous administrations have done a good job, but it's a difficult position to be in. But I do have a suggestion or a comment, and that would be that it'd be interesting if management and labor who are currently handling, public trash pickup for residential, came together and bid in an open bid process against private. And I understand everybody saying that the trash pickup pays for itself, but that doesn't mean it's the lowest cost solution. So it'd be a great opportunity for management, labor to come together and say, okay, we can come up with a package and we'll respond to the RFP just like any private industry would.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you. And it's always good because too many people take a linear path in how they think. There's always answers out. There's always an alternate B, C, and D. I'm looking for them all the time. One thing I thought about, the problem with if you get like a good example when they did the No Neighborhoods Left Behind, they had a group of city workers compete with a private crew. But the problem here in enterprise is that if we did that and say the city workers with a low bid, if they're still city workers, you'd lower the rate. You can't charge a franchise fee. One idea I thought was about 4 or 5 years ago, they talked about forming a separate public utility commission board that would basically take responsibility for rate setting of the board of directors away from the city itself. Now, the question would be if that type of entity were there and they employed the city workers at it'd be a little different structure, but maybe comparable benefits and so on. Would that enable the city then to also, because again, the key here is develop a franchising fee. And I don't know if that's legally possible, but it was one of the models I've looked at, I've talked to city attorney about to see if there's any feasibility, and there may not be, but I'm looking at everything out there to see. And it's just not within that group itself. It's because what we have to do is two things: either identify other revenue sources or make further budget cuts. And I can tell you, I'm talking to my colleagues, nobody wants to, you know, put a cut to the senior meals program or close neighborhood centers or not have swimming lessons in the summertime. These are all amenities that are part of what a town is, a city is. And, you know, we've made so many our parks. I go to Woodward Park in my district. The lawn's dying. The trees look like crap. Nobody wants that. And then we're all in a difficult position. And I feel bad that, you know, sometimes it unfairly falls on, you know, like on garbage workers. Again, I've said from the beginning, they do a good job. The service is good. It's just born out of necessity. We are in a unique place in history in our city that we have to make difficult decisions to make sure our city survives, that we don't end up like Stockton in a bankruptcy court and our credit rating is good. Because to turn around this economy, we need jobs. And jobs means sales tax, property tax. If you're a city in financial distress, you filed bankruptcy or you're close to it, who in the hell wants to come to this city? We've got to find a way to get through this, working fairly with all the labor groups and all the management to make sure we get there hopefully by the end of the next 4 years.
Well, it's a process that's just beginning, and the public has been invited to participate and to weigh in. And I'm sure they're hoping that their voice will be heard. You know, we don't want to have happen, like you said, what happened in Stockton. And this morning before I came in, I was reading an article about Scranton, Pennsylvania, where the mayor has just cut all the city workers' pay to minimum wage, didn't take it to city council or anything. He just abruptly cut. So, and you know, so they're going to be up, you know, in court over that. But it does show you an indication of what cities are up against today. And a lot of it comes from what you said, the economy. But others, as we've all talked about here, a lot of bad decisions right now that are going to cost a lot of people possibly their jobs. And, right, and that's not a good thing. Thank you for coming in and talking to us about this issue. We're going to discuss it some more, and we appreciate your time. Fresno City Councilman Lee Brand. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno and Cahuilla Delta Medical Center.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. As crops around the valley begin to near harvest time, some farmers are worried they may face a shortage of workers. Valley Public Radio's Gabriella Ornelas has this report.
The Central Valley is the agricultural center of California, producing a wide range of fruits, vegetables, and other commodities, all worked by the hands of thousands of farm workers. However, these crops may be threatened this season with a reported decrease in the number of workers. Paul Betancourt, a farmer out of Kerman and a former president of the Fresno County Farm Bureau, says the shortage could prove devastating for the industry.
The fact that we're having labor problems this early in the season is not good, because we're just hitting into the peak of season when there's demand for, you know, hand labor to get harvests out of the field. So if we're having a problem now, that doesn't say good things about how things are going to go the rest of the season.
While the Central Valley is no stranger to labor shortages, Brian Little of the California Farm Bureau explains it's not a typical concern for the ag industry. He says the last time a shortage became a major problem in the valley was in 2008, but he says reports of fewer workers this year are a cause for concern.
This is the first time in a while that we've heard farmers telling us that they're having difficulty finding enough people to do what they need to do. So I don't think it's cyclical. Something's changed, but it's pretty hard to put your finger on exactly what it is.
The California ag industry requires around 475,000 workers every peak season from August to October. But according to the California Farm Bureau, this year's supply of workers for labor-intensive crops is short by a third. As Little explains, if there aren't enough workers, at this rate, 30% of crops will simply go unharvested, which is not only a loss to the farmers, but can have a rippling effect in the local economy.
that's less money in a farmer's pocket to be able to go out and buy goods and services in the community. He can employ fewer people, and those people are going to be able to buy less in the local community.
No one truly knows the cost of the labor shortage, but many ag industry groups speculate it may be related to the issues of immigration and increased border security. According to the California Farm Bureau, about 70% of the farm workers are undocumented immigrants using fraudulent documentation. And tightened border security and enforcement may have caused many to stay in their home countries. Others suggest that a wave of violence in Mexico among drug cartels could be to blame. People like Charles Waters of the Ayala Corporation, a labor contracting company, say a guest worker program that would legally bring necessary workers to California would eliminate the shortage and also provide jobs to thousands of workers.
We need to work to have a workers program out for our laborers from south of the border. We really do, because those that yell about and complain about the illegal or the folks from south of the border, those are the people who for years and years and years have been picking his crops. These complainers about them, that complain about them coming here, these people are not really the ones that are, they won't step out in the field and harvest the crops. It takes these special, hardworking type of people to do this.
Still, others are not convinced the immigration is the cause of the recent labor shortage. Betancourt says immigration has affected the ag industry for years, but border security initiatives have diminished its influence in the last decade.
I think the immigration thing has played out already before. That's been an issue for years. The border pretty well sealed up after 9/11, so people aren't going back and forth across the border like they were before. So I would have expected more of an instant problem the first few years after 9/11 if border security was an issue.
Regardless of the cause, Farm Bureau leaders say they are lobbying Congress to pass laws that will help provide a steady labor supply for the future. As for this year, farmers say the shortage could result in laborers flocking to the valley in search of work, but if not, many of their crops may never make it out of the fields. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Gabrielle Ornelas.
And joining us to further discuss this issue is Manuel Cunha with the Nisi's Farmers League and Patricia Stever Blattler, Executive Director, Tulare County Farm Bureau. Thank you both.
Thank you for having me.
For joining us today. First of all, are we seeing a shortage now, or is this something that they're talking about, they're expecting?
Well, this shortage started in February in the Salinas Valley of this year when planting transplants. So the shortage is real, and it's already happened, is happening, and is increasing because the amount of production that we have across the state at the peak of the San Joaquin Valley is the largest in the whole state of where so much activity takes place. Our peak here is right around August 15th. We will hit a peak of about 230,000 farm workers in the eight counties of the San Joaquin Valley, picking a variety of everything from vegetables to tree fruit to grapes to wine grapes, raisins, even livestock. So it's real and it's true.
When we talk about shortage, that's one of the things, you know, for farmers, growers, it can mean different things. Are we talking about a shortage to the point of you won't see crops harvested? Are we talking about shortage and they just don't have the number that they would like to have?
You know, between all of the ag groups in this valley and this state, the numbers that we see in an average farm labor contractor, because that's the largest employer in this valley, is farm labor contractors. We see a crew that has 20 people to 25 people down to 15. So that impact is going to be real for not harvesting those crops. This is a repeat, and most people probably weren't born yet, but in 1998 we had a massive shortage in this state. And in the San Joaquin Valley, it started the same way. It started early in the year and then progressed through the harvest season. But we were short 80,000 workers, and we had wine grapes never got harvested, tree fruit that never got harvested, table grapes that didn't finally get packed. vegetables that didn't get harvested either. So there was a real economic impact to this valley, to the state, even to all the farm employees' income was way less. So we see the same pattern right now occurring.
And Ms. Blattler in Tulare County, are you seeing the same thing?
Yes, I agree with Manuel. I mean, all the indicators that we're seeing across the valley is that the shortage is somewhere between a 25 to 30% reduction in people available to work in these jobs. The early season activity, you know, all the way up through harvesting. So crews that normally had, you know, 10 might be down to 6 or 7 people. Five crews that were harvesting pears, maybe 3 to 4 crews this year. So, you know, we are seeing that overall reduction in the available workforce, and it does have a very real ripple effect throughout the economy. As Manuel mentioned, it reduces overall, pay to the workers that are available, and it certainly has a ripple effect in the entire economy of our valley.
We heard a number of reasons as to why. And it is something that, the ag industry has experienced. I'm not going to say every year, but there's been an increasing problem that this is not new for you. What are some of the reasons you think?
Well, we know what 9/11 did to this country. We know what it did to our neighboring countries of allowing workers to come here. In a process that this government has failed to implement is an immigration program for all of industries, but for agriculture especially. What we've seen in the last 3 years, since 2009, when we had the water taking for an endangered species by the smelt on the west side, when those workers lost their jobs, they became available employees, let's call it that, to the drug movement of Mexico, and even of this state and other parts of the United States. So these workers had to survive. So they were somewhat recruited by special people to work in that world of drugs. They had to survive. Last year was the first year that I was involved in human trafficking, of finding out problems that were coming in from Las Vegas. Workers were coming from Las Vegas that were being brought here by supervisor cartel coyotes, let's call them. And those workers were going to work in agriculture but were being controlled by these cartel, in which part of their salary has to go to the drug world. And we even have ICE enforcement right now going on in this valley, audits, where the employer has to terminate these workers. They now become vulnerable for the drug movement. The drug movement, I've talked to farm workers 2 weeks ago in Madera, and one of the farm workers' brothers was telling me, and I had a person translating, so we had a correct response, was that his brother probably had been killed because he didn't cooperate with the cartel, because they hadn't heard from him now for 6 months here in the U.S. or even in Mexico.
Well, so then you have a situation of, and I think that's what other people are concerned about, of the cartel and impacting the U.S. on the other side of the border. And that's why a lot of people are concerned. And that's what they've seen, and that's why they want stepped up border security. This has been an ongoing problem. I grew up in the valley. I mean, I was an ag person, I know about having to have workers here. But is part of the problem that, and I think a lot of us remember, I remember my parents worked in the field, and then when they could do something better, they moved up. And isn't that what the situation is? Is that people will start there, but they better themselves and they move on to another job.
Absolutely correct. I mean, that's the great opportunity about the United States. You have an opportunity to move up the ladder. But we don't have a guest worker program to replenish those workers as they leave. But in the last 3 years, that has not been the case. The case is that they are not moving up, is that the ones that are going home are not coming back at all. They haven't been home for 7, 8 years. They finally go home. They know that if they come back, they will be picked up by the drug cartel. The drug cartel have better observations versus the Border Patrol on where these persons are coming across into the United States. So they're being apprehended by them. So they fear for their life of coming back. So they're not coming back. But we, the United States, have failed on this whole immigration issue.
Ms. Blattler?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, the agricultural industry has the need and the desire to unite on this issue because all across the United States we're experiencing labor shortages. They're just uniquely different in California because of the, you know, unique specialty crops that we grow, the high perishability, the narrow margins and windows that we operate within to get the crops out of the field and to the marketplace makes California even more vulnerable to these labor shortages without meaningful, you know, national immigration reform. And we do have a significant problem at our border. We have the fear of not being able to move back and forth across the border, you know, like we did 10, 12 years ago. 9/11 and many of the new rules that are in place, guarding the border, have changed the total dynamic of the workforce that is available to travel to and from California as well as other states. And even though we need border security, this country was built on agriculture, and our economy is derived from agriculture, and we need that workforce available. And earlier you commented about people being able to move up the ladder into better paying opportunities and better paying jobs. And, you know, these are good paying jobs. I talk to farmers every day that are paying their workforce, you know, $15, $18, $20, $25 an hour for this work. And yeah, it is hard, backbreaking, hot work this time of year. But it is very difficult to find people that have the skill set and the ability and the willingness to work in these jobs. And we really do have, you know, different dynamic now than we had maybe the last cycle of this issue going back several decades. We've got a whole different set of federal issues to address in terms of the immigration needs of this country.
Well, you know, immigration and immigration policies are huge. It's a huge conversation in the country right now, and you're right. Our elected officials, federal government right now, they have not acted on a comprehensive plan. But whatever the comprehensive plan is, when you look at the tone of the country, the tone of the country is more of they would prefer an immigration policy that didn't let people in.
And yes, but it's the way that the Congress has framed it and the way the Congress has set it up to where our news process in this country doesn't give the immigrants that do come here, that do work in our industries, the credit that they deserve. Many of the people today in Washington are very healthy, and they're very healthy because of the farm employees of this country and the farmers that make all that food available in the United States that's safe. But one last thing I would like to say, I know we're running out of time here very shortly, is that this week's going to be a very hot week across this state and many others, but especially California. I would encourage all of our farm labor contractors and growers to make sure that our farm workers, farm employees, the people that produce the food and help get it to the market, take and drink water and think about safety and health this whole week. Because they are important to our farms. They're important to our society. So I'm asking all the contractors and farmers to make sure their workers have all the heat illness prevention safeties in place this week and in all throughout the rest of the summer because they are an integral part of our valley.
And thank you so much for saying that. And in light of that and you mentioning that, you know, you could argue that that is part when it comes to trying to find people to do this work. When it is this hot, we have policies in place that say, okay, don't send your kids out to play. Athletes, please stay inside. People stay inside. But yet the farm workers are working in this, even though you are taking precautions and urging people to be safe. You know, they work in conditions that most people would not work in. That's tough. But I really appreciate you taking time on this program to talk about safety and encourage people to be safe this time. You both say the answer to this, then, is a guest worker program. And I know you've been working toward that for years and pushing that.
Yes. I think with all the farm bureaus, all the ag groups in this state and other states and the National Acre Group, Craig Riegelberger and Monty Lake in D.C., all of us want to take care of the workers that are currently here, putting them in a legal program. And then when we have shortages, then be able to bring guest workers from foreign countries through a process that is very workable and for the employee as well as for the grower. So I really am hoping that we can get something through this year, but we've been at it for 10 years strong.
Right. I know it's been a long discussion. A long discussion. And I know that's what you're both fighting for as well. Ms. Blattler, joining the folks here in Fresno, Tulare County, urging a guest worker program as well.
Yes. You know, Manuel has fought these wars and these battles for many, many years, and he is certainly an icon and a leader in our industry. And, you know, it's sad to watch 10 years go by and say we're still fighting the battles. You know, one of our last meaningful reform acts was in 1986, and there has been a lot that has transpired since then that has made, you know, agriculture's burden in this country much greater. And it really is a unified goal for all of agriculture, you know, and there are other industries that also depend on foreign-born workers, and there are outdoor occupations that have been around for centuries that have always required workers to work outdoors in the heat, and, you know, we certainly have done a lot to be proactive in training our employers and supervisors and workers to better understand and prevent heat illness. But agriculture and other outdoor occupations will always have those, you know, outdoor conditions that they have to contend with. And as Manuel mentioned earlier, you know, safety is so critical on our farms and ranches this week and throughout the rest of this hot summer. But this is not a new issue. This is an issue we have addressed, and we need to move forward now and put in place the federal safeguards to help continue ensuring for this workforce.
Well, thank you both, Manuel Cunha with the Nisi's Farmers League and Patricia Stieber-Blattler, Executive Director, Tulare County Farm Bureau. Thank you both for joining us this morning. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Anita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. Well, you know, it is summertime. The kids are out of school, and parents are always looking for activities for their children. And there's this ongoing program at California State University Fresno that's not only fun, but your kids learn a lot. Here to talk about it is Stephanie Trevino Gander with Kids Invent. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, let's talk about Kids Invent. Basically, the kids invent.
Yes, basically they invent. We have several different camps for K through third graders and 4th through 8th graders. And our camps are Young Inventors. And then we have a series of older camps designed for older kids, robotics, science, and digital videos.
Now, are these camps still open? Because they're very popular and they can close up very quickly.
You know what? Unfortunately, next week is our final week of camps, and our robotics camp is overbooked by 5 students, but we still have a few spots left in our Young Inventors camp.
Yeah, robotics is a very, very popular camp. Kids love to build them.
Oh, yes. Every year it's our first camp to sell out, and every year we have parents a little bit frustrated that they're on the waiting list, and has anybody canceled so I can get on? It's always our first camp to sell out, and very popular since Avengers came out and Transformers. The kids want to learn everything about robotics.
Yes, they do. Now, with a program like this, It really can help a student, a young person, with their other academics when school starts.
Exactly. Here at Kids Invent, we teach the kids a lot of science and math basics. They'll get a lot of that in the robotics camp. They'll learn about the scientific method and just more technical aspects of building. They learn about circuitry, circuit boards, sensors, and how to put something very difficult together. In our digital videos, they learn more special effects and sound effects for videos. They learn basic acting skills and photography skills. And in science camp, that's where a lot of our science and math comes into play. They learn about the scientific method. Once again, they have to do math and learn about buoyancy and different scientific terms to enable them to do their projects. And the same holds true for our young inventors. And in addition to learning these basic school concepts, the kids learn about how to work in teams and work with each other and overcome adversity and difficult situations when working with 30 other kids.
Well, you know, much has been said in this country about really the lack of science and math, not enough students pursuing science and math majors. Is this a way to introduce them early and show them the fun part of science and math?
Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity to teach the kids about science and math. You know, when you think science and math, you think sitting in a desk dissecting insects or boring stuff. It's really cool. They don't know that making a boat or launching rockets, that all involves science. They don't know that involves force and gravity and different scientific concepts. They just see the fun in building these toys, which is what we want, but we also want them to kind of remember the basic concepts that they learned as kindergarten through eighth graders and hopefully take them on to middle school and high school and then do something with it in their future careers.
Yeah, it's a good way to introduce them. Now, do you have, when it comes to the camp participants, because you're dealing with science and math, but you make it fun, you have just as many young women as you have young men who want to participate, or have you seen a change in more girls wanting to be in this camp?
Over the last 2 years, I've really seen more girls start to participate in this camp. Our Young Inventors Camp is a good balance of little boys and little girls participating. But with the older camps this year, our robotics class has grown significantly with young women. We used to only have two or three. Now we're having about 10 to 12 young women participating in our camps. In our digital videos camps and science camps, it's a good split of 50-50. So we have about 15 girls and 15 boys. So the girls are starting to get more inventive and be focused on science and math and even talking about being engineering majors when they get to the college level.
Oh, that's great. And that's kind of what you want. Now, in this camp, because we talked about, you know, it's very popular and it would probably be too late for people to try to get their kids in. But if when you look at this, shouldn't people maybe start planning at the end of this camp for next year if this is a place where they really want their kid to be?
Typically, I get asked those questions. Can I be on the primary sign-up list for next year? And we don't have our summer camp dates for next summer planned probably until February, only because there might be different events going on in the university. We want to make sure that we're scheduled at a prime time for our students and to also make sure that the Clovis Unified and Fresno Unified School Districts are out of session. But the best time to start thinking about signing your kids up for camp is about February when we open up our camp dates. And we don't get heavy registrations till about end of April, early May. So if you want to get your kids in camp, February to the end of April is the prime time.
And you're right. It's always about signing up early. And you'll see that with a lot of camps that in February, they've kind of set the agenda. Mm-hmm. And by March and April, they're full. So people should really, especially this one, because it's so much fun.
Exactly. If you want to get your kid in camp, check out our website. We keep it updated. Check out our Facebook. Like us on all our social media outlets because we keep telling you camp dates will be up in a couple weeks. Keep your eyes peeled. And we also have an email blast as well that we use to inform parents or interested parents or grandparents about our upcoming camps and events.
Okay. Thanks so much, Stephanie Trevino-Gander, for coming in with Kids Invent at California State University, Fresno. It's a great program. Thanks for joining us. And thank you for joining us this morning. Remember, you can catch us online at kbpr.org. For everyone here at KBPR FM 89, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you have a great afternoon.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.